This is the one and only Red Ice Radio. Welcome, my name is Henrik. Thank you for stopping by redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We are grateful, as always, to have you with us. We've been going on the radio front since spring 2006, and the website that goes back prior to 2003, that's over 10 years ago now. Wow, it's just amazing how the time flies. And, you know, I built the website from the ground up myself, and everyone that today are with us are working as hard as ever to bring you interesting topics that we find valuable, insightful, and perspective-widening, but also challenging and sometimes contradictory, quite on purpose, so that you will have to use your own mind and rational processes instead of being spoon-fed what someone else says is the truth and nothing but. All right, today Neil Kramer is back on the program. He was with us way back in 2007 for the first time, and he's been coming on regularly almost every year since then. Neil is a writer, philosopher, and teacher specializing in the fields of consciousness, metaphysics, and mysticism. Kramer has made a lifelong independent study of philosophy, mystical traditions, religion, and esoteric world history. He shares his path of transformation and empowerment in writings, recordings, interviews, and lectures, as well as giving personal consultations and group workshops. Today, he's with us to discuss the divine will, the origin and source of the noumen. Hi, Neil. Thank you for coming back on the program. It was a while ago now, so I hope you've been doing well, and I know that you've been keeping busy as well, so it's good to have you back. Thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Henrik. It's great to talk to you, as ever. It has been a little while, a year or so, but it's always nice to come back and reflect upon all the different things that have happened since last time we spoke, you know?
Yeah, oh yeah. What have you been up to?
Well, I've been doing a lot of traveling, studying, exploration, you might say, contemplation and teaching work. So my teaching, my consultative work, if you like, constitutes a large part of what I do. And it's essentially providing philosophical and metaphysical and mystical insight to assist with people's personal development and unfoldment. And these are like private consultations with individuals, confidential, deep, very real. And they come to me and say, you know, I'd like to talk to you about these things in my life. And for some, that would be a one-off thing to help with a particular crossroads in life, things that come to us all the time. And for other people, it's very much an ongoing long-term relationship. So people come to see me in Portland, Oregon, and sometimes in Seattle, in Washington. And then sometimes I go out and see them, mainly in the USA, of course, but people do come from all over, and we use Skype, of course. So yeah, it's good. And I've also been recording, been making audio recordings of my ideas and observations. So instead of putting out essays, which I've been doing for many years, instead of doing that in writing, I decided to do it in spoken word. So I've been producing these field recordings, sort of spontaneous spoken word essays, which I call roamcasts, mm-hmm. because I am roaming about different places inside and out, urban and rural, normal and strange, all over the Pacific Northwest and indeed all over the US. And they add a certain sort of flavor, the outside recordings to what is being said. It makes them different and I think fresher and a bit more vivid, I think. And I explore the different kinds of subjects relating to ascendancy and growth and empowerment and all these different things. And these roamcasts are available, freely downloadable on my website. I also just gave a big weekend workshop over in Washington State, which is called Alchemy of Will. And if I don't say so myself, it was a fantastic weekend. And nice. We made a recording of that, which will be available in October, November time. And I think the other big thing is I'm also preparing a new online community called The Core. And I've been thinking about this for a while, and I think now it's time to bring it into manifestation. And this is something that will enable people through subscription to be part of a group studying some of the deeper principles in life, frankly. And there will be regular video cast broadcasts by me, audio MP3 downloads, or, you know, really strong members forum so everyone can keep in touch and exchange ideas. And we'll discuss modern mysticism in real life and real metaphysics in our daily lives and look at how that is being reflected in world events in real time as they unfold. And, you know, the central idea behind The Core is to provide a space where people can gather, you know, remotely at first and then in the future physically. But from the beginning, to be part of something, to feel part of something authentic and ongoing, because a lot of people come to conferences and seminars and whatnot, all different people, all different kinds of subjects, and then they go away and it's back into normal life and they sort of lose it. So I wanted to create more of a regular touchstone for keeping that sort of fire of awakening alive and healthy, a place of insight and piercing honesty and willful ascendancy. And it is my intention to create this place and provide a platform where our lucidity and fellowship can be consistent. So this is what I'm creating, and it will be available soon. So people can watch, you know, neilcramer.com and keep abreast of development. So yeah, I have been a busy bee.
Nice. So you're a philosophical lecturer and teacher, but is any of this bridging into, you know, psychology? Would you call yourself a psychologist, Neil?
Well, it's hard not to, isn't it, when you do this work? And I would imagine it's the same for you. When you're looking at freedom and control, and you're looking at the media, and you're looking at government, you cannot help but become involved in the study of psychology, of the mind and of behavior and of mental patterning and programming. So that is absolutely intertwined into what I do. And I think that my kind of format of philosophy, my flavor of philosophy, is very much imprinted in real life. It's not academic philosophy. It's not something I would describe as, I sit in an office in a tweed suit with a pen and ink and write things and pontificate and ruminate and then push little books out now and again. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. If somebody wants to do that, fine. But for me, the philosopher, the person who loves wisdom, the real joy of it and the real, you know, meat of it is to bring it into the felt experience of life. And traditionally, the European sage and philosopher would go out and be very much this Renaissance type figure, where they would have to equip themselves with many disciplines. So you would need to be a philosopher and a psychologist, although obviously they didn't quite use that word then, but someone who understood human behavior, sociological impulses, emotions, the emotional landscape, critical, absolutely of critical importance. And then also the esoteric, so the mystical principles that guide the universe, as well as the science of that, also the invisible aspect of that. And so, yes, psychology is one kind of one color in the spectrum, really, that you can't ignore. And what we have to do, of course, is choose how much time and energy to put into it, because you can't endlessly examine somebody's motives and patterning and the knots they've created inside themselves from traumatic experience. And I think, like Woody Allen, you know, you could spend your whole life in therapy, couldn't you, really? And just on and on and on and on, just endlessly discussing problems. For me, there's a threshold, which is you could, in our terminology, perhaps call it the deconditioning threshold, where it is possible to take a person to a position of cleanliness and purity and strength and balance and say, okay, let us examine the faulty thinking that has been inculcated into you from empire culture, from the control system, from machine culture, as I call it. And let's put you in a position of the child of wisdom. So you have that freshness, the Zen mind, beginner's mind, as our Japanese friends call it. But you also have the wisdom of the adult. So you become this fresh force in the universe, which is very resilient to control and very opposed to external authority, because it isn't necessary, not because we are rebelling for the sake of it, but because we are standing on our own two feet and realizing that the authority emanates within us. So if psychology helps us achieve some of that freedom, which I believe it does, I have seen the evidence for that, then it falls upon us to educate ourselves to be our own psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists and whatever, to identify things, to formulate better patterns of behavior, to learn how to bring the heart and the mind in closer connection. So yeah, those things are very, very important to my day-to-day work.
Yeah, I mean, examining the neurosis, if you will, it is an important thing, as you say. I think something that has happened is that a lot of people are finding themselves in a returning position to psychiatry as well, because I think a lot of the people involved in that are also afraid of, I guess, breaking down, if you will, people too much. It's become a little bit like a pill, if you will. It's meant to patch up, you know, temporarily, so that you can, you know, kind of withstand the pressure that you're under or deal with something temporarily. But soon enough, you find yourself in a situation where you have to return, you know. But really getting deep into it can be a really time consuming task. It should be, and it could be such a extensive process that you might not be able to do everything that you've done previously. Let's say keeping a job, even in some cases, people have you know, they go deep and they need that time to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very funny that it's very true, and that's why balance is so critical here, to balance these forces of our mental and emotional and will faculties, which we'll obviously come to talk about will and the nature of will. But yeah, if you go too far down one rabbit hole, you tend to miss out on all the other spectrum of awareness and life expression. So if you're always studying, you never create. If you're always creating, you never study. If you're always in fear, it's hard to develop courage, you know. And if you're always stupidly bold and confident and innocently naive, you make a lot of mistakes and fall over. So it's about understanding the center point on this compass of expression and awareness, understanding that, as the martial artist learns, that to stand at the center and to be always in balance gives you an incredible advantage when change occurs. And as change is constantly fluctuating and undulating through our lives and presenting us with the good and the bad and the black and the white, to be in a position of balance is really the only path forward, because the positive path creates imbalance and the negative path creates imbalance. So to neutralize those forces and to understand that there's a point of equilibrium is very important, because otherwise you go off with the fairies, as it were, and you can't pay your rent check next month, or, you know, somebody comes and takes your car away because you've forgotten how to go to the office, or you can't talk to your parents anymore, all kinds of mundane things. If you go down the wrong reality tunnel, you start to dishonor some of the things in your life that require your perception. So it brings about a very grand and important and precious opportunity. My philosophy of authentic living and the things that you're talking about, you know, the same angle, really, you know, of a very parallel path. It brings about a great opportunity to examine what's important and what isn't important, and to make changes on that basis. So in my teaching, I do have these initiatory stages, really, where after a long period of observation, which usually lasts many years, the initiate will then move into a stage of reformation, reforming their life based on the observations they've made.
Yeah.
And you and I are good examples of that, just with what we were talking about prior to the show.
Yeah.
In that, when you know the path very deeply, it actually becomes very hard not to walk it. And you start to almost feel that the path is walking you and that life is living itself through you, and you become this conduit, this vessel. And of course, we lend our own color and personality and thoughts and ideas and creativity. But really, that isn't possible without a lot of observation. And that means study and reason and focus and dedication. A lot of people, as we know, are good at starting things but not finishing it. With this observational stage of life, which is a very well-precedented mystical initiatory stage, as you complete that, you're then in a position to go through a reformation, as we would have reformation periods in religion and in history and in society. So we do in our own lives, where you think, okay, well, this, based on what I've observed deeply about the universe and the world and myself and the relationship between those things, I can now place myself in a position to decide what I want to do, where I want to be, who I want to be with, how long I want to spend in service to others, how long I want to spend in service to self, where that's located in the world, because often it is not the place that you started off. The path of knowingness and the ascendant path often entail travel, or should we say journeys. Sometimes they're physical, sometimes they're not, but it often entails this journeying, which is always very reformational in itself, because when you are journeying as opposed to holidaying, which is something very different, you cannot help but embrace change, because that is very much the spirit of what you're doing, which is you're riding the crest of this transformation as you travel. And then to then go back, as you were indicating previously, and sit in an office for 6 months can be very challenging, if not impossible.
Yeah.
So you have to examine carefully what it is that you're about. So that observation stage, as I say, will last many years. And then we go into reformation, which lasts many years to make those changes. And then following that, there's a stage of selfhood, which is full expression of self, all self, light and shadow, creation and destruction. So these are the principles of my work, and being able to identify in ourselves that we can move through these three phases into the fourth phase of, to use an old word, seership, S-E-E-R. To be a seer was to be someone who can make contact with truth, the truth of reality, the truth of life, the truth of oneself, the truth of any situation or thing. That's what a seer was. And in later times, we came to associate that with someone who was able to perform divination, you know, to see into the future, to see somebody's fortune, as it were. But initially, a seer was what we would call a wizard, somebody now who we see has an ability to move shamanically in the world, to shapeshift, to have telepathy and telekinesis and all these interesting things, by virtue of the fact that they have acknowledged and expressed the multidimensionality of themselves. So they recognize that they live as an animal in the world, which they do, and they do not denounce that, and they do not diminish it. And at the same time, simultaneously, they recognize there is another aspect of themselves in what the Druids called the invisible world, which I sometimes call the 4D, which you might call the, you know, the quantum vacuum or whatever, you know, the other space. And we're in those realms at the same time, at the same place. And things that are very, very normal in the 4D appear miraculous here. So, as Auspensky said, in search of the miraculous is an attempt to pierce those two worlds, to pierce the veil, to reach through from the 3D and say, give me something concrete. Give me a miracle. And that miraculous discovery is completely and utterly dependent on your own willingness to change yourself.
Wow. So obviously the observational stage is very important, and maybe there's more to talk about there as well. But, you know, for one, there's just that majority of people don't get to, you know, any of these stages. They don't end up in this self-observation stage, of course. But
yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about will here and why this is so important to be self-directed, to take control, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think we all have an idea in ourselves of what will might be and how it expresses itself in our life. In regular life, consenting to the things that we've been asked to believe in by our machine society, we risk living inside what I would describe as a huge binary equation. We are asked to consider the world and interact with the world either with mind or with heart, right?
Yeah.
To be intellectual or emotional. And on the surface, that seems a very simple proposition and even a fair one. But at its roots, I would say that that is a false proposition and has enormous gravitation. It sucks people into its erroneous thinking and it squashes them. So one of the errors in our system is the splitting of human experience into two, the world of mind and the world of heart. And we are asked to regard those two things as our only equipment for perception, knowledge, feeling, experience as we go about our lives on this planet. Think and feel, calculate and sense, and that's it. So if you reflect, let's reflect on that for a second. You know, the mind, absolutely, this precious gift to humankind, the ability to reflect, to model, plan, cogitate. And we have, you know, this virtual space where we can design new things in our mind, this amazing intellectual technology we have with its different facilities that we use every day for reason and articulation and delineation, deconstruction, very important that, and analysis. And all of these things are vital things for the growth of a human being. For the ascendant path, as I call it, which is very natural, very organic, very wonderful, through the realms of the animal and the physical world and into the invisible world of spirit and transcendence and deeper kind of contact with reality, you need all those things. And then on the other hand, to go to the other end of our duality, we have the heart, this thing in our chest. Everybody listening to this, you've got one probably in your chest, beating, and every time that beats, you're alive. When it stops beating, you're out of here. So primary, so fundamental to life with its extraordinary connectivity. It connects us together, this thing, and its ability to merge energetic patterns, you know, profound emotional conductivity, you might say, intuition, creation, destruction, the ability to know deep fellowship with one another, to release, to let go, to be. You can't be without your heart. And yet, you know, with these two pieces of inner technology, do we not sooner or later come to a point where we come into conflict with ourselves because of this? And you hear this phrase spoken of being in two minds about something, right?
Yep.
You know, my brain says yes, but my heart says no. Shall I go with this woman? Shall I go for this job? Shall I, you know, move to another country? Shall I invest in this business proposition? I don't know. Shall I spend a year and go to Tibet? Or shall I go to college and get an education? I don't know. I'm in two minds. And when we come to make a decision on a problem or a choice or a pathway, we feel that it is wise, of course, to consider both, to make a consideration with both heart and mind. And more often than not, that definitely yields a better result, better insight than just relying on the coolness of the mind or the warmth of the heart. And as I say, we have this thing called machine culture, which is basically the culture of the empire, control system, military, industrial, corporate, mind conditioning, which masquerades as human culture. And it presents itself to be very natural, something that we have openly and consciously made, but it isn't. It is instead the product of disavowal, bitterness, dishonorable escapism. And we, as I've said to you before, summon these demons into the world ourselves, I have come to understand.
Yeah.
But that's another story. For now, regardless of origin, let's say that there is a machine culture at work that gives us bad government, bad education, and an inauthentic society. And one brilliant trick that machine culture plays on us is to polarize our mind and heart so much that we tend to secretly favor one over the other.
Right.
And in a sense, we're asked to choose, which are you? Are you a mind person or a heart person? And you know, don't change it. Once you've chosen it, that is what you are. And you can have little flirtations with your negative polarization, with your opposite, but don't mess about too much with it or you'll get burned. So if you're a mind person, you are instructed through machine culture that it is appropriate to largely disregard your heart and vice versa. So we see lots of these very cold, detached, repressed, argumentative, nuts and bolts, focused, dispassionate men of logic and women. And they tend to do well in business and politics and science.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they're good people, but that's the characteristics. And they're often individually focused. And if you try to talk to them about many of the matters that you discuss on your show on spirituality, metaphysics, other worlds, other orders of highly sentient life, they will reject it outright because they have to. They have to. Unconsciously, in their root programming, they have to because they are mental animals. So anything from the other world is an abomination.
Yeah.
And the opposite of that is the heart people, very warm, open, sensitive, go with the flow, asymmetrical, expressive, but, you know, unpredictable, imprecise, bad at finishing things, moody, scatty, right? And they do well in art and music and new age things and sociology. And we all know people like that who are heavily polarized in one of those two worlds. And we in ourselves know we all do it a little bit. And sometimes it might be appropriate to bring the mind to the fore or the heart to the center of an issue, definitely. You know, you try making love with just the mind or doing mathematics with just your heart and you'll end up in a mess, you know.
Right.
So the wise human, seeing that the heart and mind have great power in the world, tries to combine them, to have them flow into each other. And sometimes that works, but often it doesn't, right? With the very wisest of men and women, often that doesn't work. And this is where we come to this matter of will. In many situations in life, we cannot get to the truth of a thing with just the heart or just the mind, nor by combining them. The mind cannot know what it does not know. The heart cannot feel what it's not aware of. And the mind, for me, falls into the spectrum of the animal, the physical, the 3D life. But it creates a bridge to the heart. And the heart is a link to something higher, a higher aspect of ourselves, the soul, we could reasonably call it. And the feelings come not just from thoughts and chemicals, but from something else that we don't understand, that we do not know about. You see, there's something missing when we live our life with just those two components. There's another element in addition to the heart and the mind, the great binary theater of no and yes, sun and moon, alive and dead, something and nothing. You know, we can examine it by, if we use our Latin for a minute, and I'm not an expert at this, so it's a bit general, this, but Latin kind of like is our ability to see groups of words and what they mean. So when we speak in English, you tend to be very specific and pinpoint one word. If you think of Latin, you know, the mind, cogito, to think, to conceive, to map, to detach, to be objective. It's quite a nice term, that, which describes, you know, what the Hindus might call the brow energetic portal, right? And kuono, the heart, to unite, to connect, to merge with, to attach, to be subjective, core, heart, C-O-R. Again, the center of the chest, the very big thing. So that other missing element, the will, this is the key thing. The will is that point of balance. And this isn't the will of ego, or, you know, forthrightness and assertiveness. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not using the word will in that manner. Those kind of things are a very human, low vibration, essentially no different to the will of an animal vying for alpha male status, you know, like in wolf packs and stags and lions.
Right.
Speaking esoterically, we're using the word will in a different way. In Latin, I am terming this numen, N-U-M-E-N, which means divinity, divine power, divine will, God. And you can place this, if we, again, think of it as Hindu formulation of the chakras, we can place this at the solar plexus, will. And I emphasize the word solar there for the attentive listener. And this is why the will is so powerful, so meaningful, so controversial. It is through this will that we find balance. And it's through this, the radiance of will, we come to know things. Through the experience of flesh, of being alive as an animal, we feel the truth of these things. And it is will that enables us to sustain our lucidity. Because without consistent, self-sustaining lucidity, we keep forgetting things. So people will read a book and then forget, or they'll go to a thing, an event, and forget.
Yeah.
Or they'll start to become wise and then they'll slip back again, because will Will is something that emanates, this is a little bit esoteric, but bear with me, from the core, from the center of the universe, right into the core, the center of us. It's always true, it's always complete, it's always available to us. And it is only the static, the fog of our erroneous thinking that separates us from this signal from the center of the universe. A signal from the center of the universe that comes to us every moment of every day. For, as I say, in reality, it's there all the time. We just have to learn to create a space to receive it. So the journey of will is a long and mysterious one. And the fuller our cup of mind with whatever, the less we can tune into it. The more excitable the heart, the harder it is for us to hear, it's the wise counsel of this signal, of this voice.
Right.
So we have to have the abilities of the monk, the hermit, the sage, the philosopher. We have to bring neutrality into our being for a time, for a moment. You know, there's nothing, doesn't mean we can't go out and go crazy and have fun with our friends and play our instruments and paint and study and do our quadratic equations. You can do all those things, definitely. But to be able to bring yourself to a point of balance is absolutely essential. So speaking very practically about this mysterious thing, this will, this higher will, those higher aspects in ourselves that we all have derive from this transcendental core, from this will, our sense of integrity, honesty, and honor. They come from will, not the mind. The mind's not bothered about that stuff. The heart doesn't mind either. It doesn't care. It's not bothered. Those things, honor, honesty, integrity, they are beyond mind, beyond heart. And when we build those things into our everyday life, when we make honor and integrity a major part of what we do, we become more powerful, more truthful. And if we find it hard, on the other hand, to behave with high conduct, to emanate our honor in our thoughts and feelings and deeds, then it means we've become separated from our will. Our inner fire has gone out. It's been dampened by an over-reliance on mind or heart. So you see, this dualism that I'm speaking of, you know, you see it endlessly reflected in Hollywood extrapolations and expositions of mind and heart. You know, infinite number of sickening romantic comedies and horrible science fiction horror blockbusters, all aiming to polarize you into being either the calculator or the fluffy bunny, the fluffy rabbit. That's you right. choose. And you can see this heavily represented in society, in music, in liberal politics, in conservative politics, in the military, in education. And all of them, without exception, deny the existence of will. They have to. The existence of this fantastic soul illumination, this signal, this noumen, this will, is incredibly dangerous to machine culture, to the empire. Why? Because the will is of divine origin, and it is therefore something that confers upon the individual absolute sovereignty. If a human being takes this will into their being, into their mind and heart, it balances them out. It adds this point of reference that is beyond the animal. So we begin to understand through this our multidimensional component. And people throw that word around. I just mean the fact that we exist in many spaces at the same time. And when you do that, we see that the avatar in the game, the character in the game, is not us. That in fact, we are the will playing the game. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing that takes us out of the 3D, 4D Maya game and outside of the whole thing to the place from which these realms were created and to the place from which we came, our home, our origin, our return.
So this is a deeper quest or guidance that's underlying all of this. But if we, let's say we ask this question from a point of view that we don't understand what it is or have even gotten a peripheral contact with it yet, what is this noumen concerned with on our level, let's say? Is it a personal thing, a greater plan that guides those who listen to it and ultimately follow it, Neil?
Well, this is the long and mysterious journey of the will, because as you begin the journey, if the answer is too grand and too complex, we wouldn't take another step, would we? We just think that's too weird. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
I'll do something else. So initially, it presents very simple things to you. And if anybody listening to this senses, of course, a familiar spiritual context to some of this that I'm talking about, you're right, there is, because at the roots of Christianity, all the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Islam, etc., there is this same single truth. And then, of course, about 2,000 years ago, there was an attempt to bury it, annul it, or at the very least to distort it. So for millions of people going to church or temple or synagogue or whatever, they will not see this will. In fact, they're instructed that it is quite removed from them. It is separate. It is something outside of them, this God's will, as a Christian would call it, and something that would be better to be fearfully or reverently worshipped. It's not human. Humans are bad, flawed, a mess. There's no divine will there. Wrong. The divine will, the perfect truth, this higher integrated life principle, is an emanation from the very core of the universe. So in my philosophy of this, it's rather like the philosophy of emanationism, but with a different kind of language and a different kind of contemporary bearing to it, which is suggesting that the universe, number one, is a work in progress. It's not finished.
Right.
Number two is attempting, through its own faculty of intelligence, to refine itself and to correct mistakes, because large parts of this universe were not created by the oneness, or God, as you might say, the ineffable one, the unbegotten one. They were created through a free will experiment, as the Gnostics have pointed out to us, by other lesser beings, right? So nevertheless, that will still flows, the perfect signal to say, refine, evolve, become more elegant. Beauty is a sign of this thing, universal beauty. Truth, very important in our realms. The truth of a situation, the truth of what happens, that flows through all of us, and it flows through man as much as it does any creator, any angel, any ascended master or secret chief or enlightened extraterrestrial or Jesus or Buddha or anyone. And that is our primary disavowal. We talked about disavowal and renunciation of our power before on this program. That's a primary disavowal. To say there's nothing divine about me. I can't see it. I can't feel it. I don't know what you're talking about. I can't say that. So if you've ever wondered why the world is such a state, such a mess, why do we have HAARP and chemtrails and energy weapons and destruction of, you know, these fake terrorist events and PSYOPs and fluoride and aspartame? Why do we poison our planet?
Yep.
Dishonorable men and women administrating our affairs in the White House and Downing Street, because we're not exercising our will. We are therefore, when we're not doing that, not sovereign. We give in. We become subjects. We become subjects, and it's time, you know, to begin to analyze that and understand it. And that touches on many things: the journey of unfoldment that mystics have talked about for years, to go off, to find yourself, to understand these unspeakable, difficult to define, beautiful truths, but also very practical things, very, very practical things, ideas of what is a corporation? What is your commerce with a corporation? What is your debt? What is your status as a civilian? What is your property? What are deeds? What is a title? What is capital? Do you need certificates and passports and licenses and permits? So will, as well as having its esoteric element, as its very, very important exoteric element, which is that all that stuff that underpins the control of our society also requires deep reevaluation. And in a way, and believe me, I've studied this with some of the pioneers of this in recent years, it's just as mysterious and esoteric as the inner journey, this outer journey. You know, we don't know what those things are.
Yeah.
We don't know what currency is. We don't know what why do we need a certificate for something? And until we do know that, until we study these delusions, these spells of subservience, we cannot rip them up at the roots and throw them out. So the journey of will is a big one, and it begins with concepts and thoughts and ideas, and then it moves on to actions and deeds and creation and destruction.
Let me ask you this. There's an interesting thought here. In a way, it could also be seen as a perhaps an organizing force. The things you spoke about in terms of control and the grid that we've set up has, you know, there is this reluctancy to think, you know, among many people, I'm not included in that, but that people think that as soon as you would let go of that control, things would fall apart, people would kill and rape each other kind of thing.
That's right.
so there's no trust in that things can, you know, flow and has a guidance.
That's a very, very, very important observation. I'm glad you said that. That is one of the beautiful things about will, is that it is an underlying principle that flows through everything. The Gnostics call it epinoia, which is the thought and the design of the creator that flows through life. It's like the algorithm that says, this is how you build things. This is how you grow things. This is how you make things cool and strong and harmonious, right? And that principle is inside all of us. All human beings have that principle, all of us. And by tuning it out through society, through machine culture, we've lost it. So we all have this secret suspicion that although we'd like to see authorities go away in their current form and a more simple, light administrative layer of excellence come across the planet, we know that right now, if you did that, there would be anarchy of a hostile nature. Anarchy, in its true sense, is quite a wonderful thing. But hostile anarchy, is something else. I just call it Mad Max world, you know, where everybody's driving around with red Mohicans and crossbows or whatever.
Right.
So nobody wants that. And it is my assertion, having traveled around this world quite a lot in recent times, especially in the last 10 years, and met people from all corners of the world, that nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. Real people don't want that. The only people who want that are the people who have a vested interest in maintaining conflict. So it is my understanding that only a mental illness and a fragility of will creates the situation where if a hurricane comes through your town, if a problem comes through your neighborhood, like there was one recently in Acapulco, most people are trying to rebuild, keep each other safe and sound, and other people go down to the store and steel televisions and vacuum cleaners. And you're thinking, you know, what is going on? What is wrong with you people? But of course, that's just a very small symptom of an endemic problem in society, which is the unfair distribution of education more than anything else, because that affects wealth. So it's not just about the money, it's about knowledge and about sentience within our communities. You know, who are we? Do we know each other? Do we have access to wisdom? That's primary. And in most societies that I've seen that function well, they have that. They know who they are personally. They communicate with each other. They communicate with the people around them, and they have access to wisdom. In all many different traditions, they have access to wisdom. When communities don't communicate and do not have access to wisdom, to sacred knowledge, to metaphysics, to higher conduct and why that's good, they crumble and they go on a descendant path. So in many old European mystical traditions, there were a number of paths that were formulated: a transcendent, ascendant, latent path, and then subjacent and descendant. So the subjacent path is where you start to forget. And the descendant path is where you are actively living a life of destruction in order to exist. And that happens, and that's what machine culture is basically suggesting, that everybody is on a descendant path. Some people do it in a shirt and tie with a career, and some people do it with a 45 caliber pistol tucked down the waistband and a a dime bag in the back pocket. And it's both exactly the same thing because it's built on these false concepts of commerce being at the center of human society, which it isn't. It's nothing to do with being a human being. Commerce is about as important as, you know, what color socks you've got on. Doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter, you know? And yet we are asked to consent to a society and a culture that places success exclusively in the hands of merchants. So unless you have a mercantile disposition and unless you are willing to trade and be an agent of commerce, you will find yourself living in a world that is very alien. So all sensitive, wonderful, introverted human beings who have this natural philosophical impulse, they feel like they've been born in the wrong millennium. They're thinking, what am I doing in this world? This world is broken. It's bizarre. It's crazy. And it's because it's so polarized to the opposite. The world is offering us the world of being extroverted. It's saying, if you can be an extrovert, you'll enjoy this world. But as you know, Henrik, all people who tend towards the philosophical and the mystical and the spiritual and the truthful have an introverted impulse. So we may arrive with this tendency and this predisposition, but all humans have the ability to transcend it. And as soon as you begin the spiritual path, you will find great beauty and peace in your introversion. Try taking that into a big city and you'll have a lot of problems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the city is an exchange with the individual to say, this is a place for extroverts. Do not come here if you're an introvert or you'll end up on Prozac. You know, and that's it. If you want to be an introvert, then become a monk or a nun or a musician or an artist, and maybe that's the only things you can do. My proposition to ourselves and to the listeners is that introversion is a very important part of human perception, and without it, we can't see. So ironically, you have to look inside before you can make any sense of what's outside. You have to. So the wonderful thing about this journey of will is that it starts to blur the boundaries between the two, where the more illumination you bring within yourself, where you have the courage to look at all your own dark corners, to acknowledge your shadow and your destructive nature, which is absolutely fine, just like a forest will need to destroy itself to renew itself, or just like a supernova will have to happen to birth new universes, right? Destruction, essential element of life.
Yeah.
And yet we are asked to believe that it's a bad thing. So foundational things like that have to be upturned right back to that initial thing of reformation, based on what we can observe about truth through our philosophy, through our forefathers who did this, through our own lives doing this, more importantly. We can then make decisions about thinking in a different way, because until you do that, you're not really in a position to go around demonstrating about anything. You have to know a truth first before you can, you know, grope around for it, because that tends to just go in circles. No bad thing, but kind of a waste of time. So my philosophy is a very natural one, which says, okay, you have this amazing mind, you have this amazing heart, you have this intellectual and emotional landscape, which will tell you loads of astonishing things about this planet and yourself and the relationship between you and your brothers and sisters. Brilliant. Very important. Makes life enjoyable. However, the real source of you is your will, because your will is both yours, free to do with what you wish, and it contains this divine principle, this enoia, this epinoia, this guiding force of refinement and perfection that you can allow into your life, into yourself, into your being. And the words we use for that, truth, balance, equilibrium, calmness, serenity, you know, all these things, illumination, noumen, right? So this light, this solar energy, this infinite energy is very, very, very important part of human life. And we've not talked about it for 2,000 years. So I am reintroducing it for discussion.
Well, very good, very good. I think we should take a little pause here, Neil. There's more I want to ask you about this, of course, the introvert qualities and how we've made the mistake in the larger society to kind of turn our backs on them, and also what the consequence of that is. But why don't we talk a little bit more about your website, Neil, before we take a short break here, and mention, do you have any estimation on the core project then, if we can call it that?
Yeah, I would hope that that's going to be available in the coming months. I'll say that because you know what it's like. As soon as you say something, all kinds of other things happen and everybody's going, where the hell is it? You know.
Yeah.
So let me say the coming months. I'm hoping to do it really fast. So in a very short amount of time, most of the infrastructure's set up and in place now. But if you look at neilcramer.com, and there's a Facebook page link from there for Neil Cramer, you know, there's news and stuff there all the time. And also on Neil Cramer, there are other downloads. You can buy my book, The Unfoldment, which came out last year, which, you know, talks about a lot of these things and is a very safe harbor if you ever want to introduce your friends and family to the exciting journey of spiritual adventure. That's what The Unfoldment, my book, is designed to do, to be a truthful place that patronizes nobody and expects nothing of anybody but presents truth. So that was the experiment with The Unfoldment, which I feel has succeeded. And there are workshops you can download there, and there's audiobooks, there's many essays, Romecasts on there that you can listen to, and of course lots of interviews with super chaps like yourself. So that's all there, neilcramer.com.
Very good. Much more there for you guys. We're going to have that linked up as well, and do check out the Unfoldment as well. Some great stuff there and all the audio feeds as well. All right. Well, Neil, we'll take a short break here. We'll return just in a little bit with much more. Much more with Neil Cramer is coming up in the second hour. Take a look at our membership options and get full access to Red Ice and everything that we've produced since our inception in 2006. And of course, all the new material and projects that we are working on right now. Much more information on redicemembers.com. Some of our upcoming guests include Phil Stanford, Kingsley Dennis, Gerard Andringer from Holland, and many more. You'll find a full and updated list in our radio archives. Thank you for listening. We'll talk more on the other side.